Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida every week at the Florida Phoenix Online, floridaphoenix.com. Craig submits a column or article on Thursdays for fresh publication, and this week's article has to do with a topic near and dear to your heart, the Florida Panther.
Well, and one in specific, Florida Panther number 260, which I guess you could say is now on, like Steven Seagal, marked for death. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has determined that this panther is a threat to human safety and therefore needs to either be taken into captivity permanently or killed. The reason they're doing that is because one very powerful rancher, a woman named Lisa Pretty, has complained about it coming in and killing her calves. And one time she saw it, and it looked at her and she got nervous. And it just strikes me as this really bizarre situation where federal bureaucrats have decided, well, that's enough for us to violate the Endangered Species Act that's supposed to protect these animals. Mm-hmm. And instead basically sentence this one to either death or life in prison.
Because this one person is afraid of it. And so that means it's considered a threat to human safety.
Yeah. Yeah. And the panther biologists for the state are all up in arms about this. I went through a whole bunch of, I think, like 400 emails involving the discussion. This from like October until now. And the Florida biologists are up in arms about this thing. Sure. Several of them have complained saying, you know, this is not a criminal. This is a wild animal. So, of course, it's going to eat whatever it comes to. And there's never been a documented instance of a panther attacking a human in Florida.
Right.
So, you know, this whole thing is that, frankly, it's a pretext for solving a financial problem. Whenever a rancher loses a calf, that costs them money. And in this case, she's lost 11 of them. But she told me today when I talked to her, she's been reimbursed for 8 of them by the Naples Zoo. So, you know, she's out maybe $2,000 tops. So is that really a reason for killing a panther? I would say not.
Yeah. One of 200, maybe
about 200, maybe. Yeah.
And a healthy individual that at one point was lauded as a tremendous success story of the rehabilitation of the species.
Yes, exactly. You know, so it's gone from a superstar to a criminal in the space of less than 6 months.
Now, these animals have a huge range. This is not like something that's stalking outside the rancher's home and, you know, knocking on the door and, you know, eyeing her kids like the big bad wolf or something. So where do they have any idea where this animal is now? Because clearly it doesn't just hang out around the ranch.
No, it's got a radio collar. It got a radio collar in December of 2020 because it got hit by a car right outside her ranch. And she called the Conservation Commission to come get it. And they came and got it, took to the Naples Zoo. Fortunately, it had no broken bones, recovered in about 2 weeks. They turned it loose south of there at one of the wilderness areas, and it successfully negotiated getting from preserve to preserve using these wildlife underpasses that have now been built. And so the Wildlife Commission issued a press release celebrating that fact, and it was even featured in a nature film called Wildlife in Our Backyards that's been showed at a couple of festivals, which said this panther is a success story. And then suddenly, it's not. Suddenly, well, it's something.
And this is the request of one individual, a rancher,
and former wildlife commissioner. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I was talking over you. Say that again.
I'm sorry. And a former state wildlife commissioner who's got some strong political connections. So,
which tells you a lot about the passions and interests of the state wildlife commission. You talk to this woman. Is she cruel? Is she dense? Is she stupid? Is she just a vicious capitalist who doesn't care about anything other than profiting off of her ranch? How does she not appreciate the rarity of this animal and that her small sacrifice in protecting this one individual could go a long way towards saving the species? Why does her self-interest become more important to her than the animal?
Well, I should say a lot of ranchers that we've talked to, and you know this too from folks we've interviewed, they look at the panthers as part of the landscape. They're part of the natural landscape here in Florida. They're happy to see them. They're happy that they're out there and that they're still prowling. Mm-hmm. Lisa Pretty is part of a small group, that views the Florida panthers as nothing other than a common feline species that is found all over the country. As she put it in one of her emails, panther is just a puma that happens to live in Florida. In other words, it's not special. It doesn't deserve endangered status. She's part of a group that has been planning to do some development in that area. And they, at one point, actually applied for a permit to take panthers. In other words, to kill them if they got in the way. And so, you know, this has been sort of a long going problem, I guess you'd say.
FloridaPhoenix.com, Craig's latest article with incredible insight into this state and its feelings about wild animals and belief in cohabitation. This episode of Welcome to Florida brought to you by Sarasota and Visit Sarasota.com. Now, here's some exciting news, some good news, actually. We talk a lot about the celery fields in Sarasota County, 400 acres of wetlands with boardwalks, walking, biking, fishing, kayaking, but especially birding. And I got a release from the Conservation Foundation of the Gulf Coast recently saying 48 acres adjacent to the celery fields has been protected forever. Conserving this land will help protect the natural environment and preserve the rural heritage of the area and the birds and animals that live there. If you are interested in birding, biking, fishing, kayaking, check out the celery fields in Sarasota and start at Sarasota Audubon's Nature Center. Visit sarasotaaudubon.org to learn more. Visit sarasota.com to learn more. And now, Craig, we are about to learn more about William Bartram.
Yes, a pioneering naturalist, a writer, and a guy who basically showed us what Florida looked like back in the 1700s.
Yeah, Bartram is a famous name around Northeast Florida where I live. There's a Bartram High School in Jacksonville. There are statues to Bartram. So who was William Bartram? Sam Carr, president of the Bartram Trail Society of Florida. Find them online at bartramtrailsociety.com is going to tell us who right now.
Tell us about William Bartram. What attracted him here in the 1700s? What was he here to do?
He actually first came to Florida in 1765. His father was the king's botanist.
Wow. And so, what a job.
Yeah. So, yeah. Britain had inherited East Florida from the Spanish, and they left in 1763. And so the king wanted to know, what did I inherit? So they sent the king's botanist, John Bartram, down here with his 25-year-old son, William Bartram, to record what they saw up and down the St. John's River, basically. Wow. And so on that trip, they traveled almost 500 miles all the way down to Hatbell Park near Sanford and back, spent most of their time in St. Augustine on that trip. And so then William got hired by the Dr. John Fothergill from Great Britain out of the Royal Society of London to come back and really cover the whole Southeast. And what they were most interested in is the animals and plants and people that were unfamiliar to Europe. And so Bartram started in 1774 in Philadelphia, and he came all the way down through seven states, and one of those seven states was here in Florida, which he really fell in love with because of his previous travels with his dad.
What was it he liked so much about Florida?
He liked the flowers and the people. So when he came down in 65, there wasn't a lot of people here because they had all left with the Spanish. The Spanish took all of the Tamuquan Indians with them when they went back to Cuba. And so that's why the Seminoles and the Creeks wound up coming into Florida. That's why there weren't any people here. So he came down here to basically draw and record his, you know, his travels through the Southeast. That's what he did for 3 years. He was here in Florida for a total of about 9 months.
That must have been amazing. And, I mean, you know, we think about Florida pre-air conditioning, pre-bug spray as being kind of a hellhole, but imagine the beauty of it. Yeah.
You know, he calls it a garden, literally. And he was really the first naturalist of America. And this was obviously spurred on by his father, who was associates of all the founding fathers of the United States up in Philadelphia. And he had a Bartram Gardens up there, which is still there. And he was growing plants and everything for export to England. So the interest was already there. Mm-hmm. But when William Bartram came down, he was under hire for people to tell him what was here. Mm-hmm. And so then he takes his journal back, and in 1791, Pab published America's first literary masterpiece named Travels. That's how Bartram got famous.
Yeah. Did he treat those trips as separate trips, or did he combine them in the book?
John Bartram's trips were actually a separate journal. Oh. Okay, because that was a very scientific journal that mm-hmm. was sent again to the king, and it was, you know, got up at, you know, 8:30 in the morning. It was 65 degrees, and the wind was it was very scientific. But William Bartram's writings, according to Mr. Audubon, were flowery words, and they are. It is a really difficult read. But the neat part about it, and the part that really got us interested in Bartram, was the fact that the places that he wrote about and that he visited are all still there. That's why we created the Bartram Trail in Putnam County.
Yeah. Wow. How accurate is his depiction? I think we've all seen these old drawings or stories about Florida, and, you know, they're looking for lost cities of gold, and there's
unicorns,
and,
yes,
yeah, unicorns and crocodiles that are 30 feet long, and mermaids and sea serpents. How accurate was his portrayal of what he found here?
Well, that's good you should ask, because you ought to see his drawing of the alligators, and of course they always vision in Europe, they thought those were dragons. And all, and because it has a very dragon looking effect to it. However, the Professor Vallette from the University of Florida, who is the alligator king there, he came to one of our symposiums to talk about William Bartram's drawing of alligators, and come to find out that everything that's depicted in Bartram's drawings of the alligators is actually true, including the smoke coming out of their nose and the fish hanging out of their side of their jaws and their backs quivering and all of that. So Bartram drew what he saw. He was very accurate for everything, especially the plants. He would not just draw a simple flower. He also drew the seeds and in some cases the root, because it wasn't art. It was documenting mm-hmm. the actual plants and animals. Same thing.
Before we move on, I have to ask you about the alligator with smoke coming out of its nose. How is that? Yeah. How is that accurate?
It's not smoke; it's water vapor. Oh. And so, Dr. Vallette showed us a film of, and he says these are usually alligators over 12 feet long. And what they do is, when they're doing their bellowing, which you don't hear a lot of that anymore. I've only heard it a time or two in my life on the St. John's River, but they fill their lungs with air. And they obviously have water and all involved with that. And when they go doing their bellowing, the water vapor comes out of their nostrils and it hangs in the air. It really does. And it was really amazing to see the films that Dr. Vallette had of those, of that actually happening. And then the vibrating, you've seen the alligators in the water and when they're vibrating during their mating season and stuff like that. Again, Bartram portrayed that in his drawing, but if you didn't know about alligators, you wouldn't know what that meant, you know?
Right.
He also drew a couple of native birds that have not been seen since he was here either.
Really? What were they?
There's a white-tipped vulture that he writes about, and he spotted it over on the coast, intercoastal. The only white-tipped vulture that is known to exist currently is actually in Africa. So it does make sense that they would come across, but since Bartram's writings, they haven't located that. And Audubon actually came down and looked for it as well.
Wow. What was the other one?
The other one, well, it's actually not here, but it does exist. It's the scrub jay that he drew the scrub jay up here in Putnam County. Huh. And, venture to say there's none here, but there are scrub jays south of
Yeah. Wow. You mentioned your time on the St. John's River, and that'll sort of take us into your next line of work with the Bartram Trail Society and some of the paddling trails that you're trying to work on. St. John's River, largest river in Florida, goes south to north, ends just past Jacksonville in the Atlantic Ocean. Tell us, for folks unfamiliar with it, just a little a short history of the St. John's River, biographic details, length, size, that sort of thing, so we're all on the same page.
St. John's River is obviously Florida's longest river. It's not the oldest, however. It's only about 15,000 years old. It's actually at one time was intercoastal, mainly, and it flows 310 miles from Blue Cypress Lake all the way down near Vero Beach out to Mayport, as you said. And it's a very shallow draft. It's only about 21 feet from, you know, and drop. So from Lake George north is all tidal. So the river literally changes direction twice a day.
Wow.
From down to Palatka and Lake George area. And it's a freshwater river. However, by dredging the mouth of the St. John's, then the saltwater intrusion has started. And it's really seven different kind of rivers. I mean, if you look at it,
seven.
The area of Blue Cypress, it's basically a marsh. And that marsh continues all the way up to basically Highway 50, and then it becomes a braided river and Puzzle Lake, and it breaks off into all kind of different channels and everything. And you know, there's no trees on the river all the way up to really you get almost to Sanford, because it's all Spartina marsh and a braided river and everything. And when you get up to Wallaca or get up to the Sanford area there past Puzzle Lake, then all of a sudden it becomes a river of lakes. So there's one lake after the other, like Jessup Lake, you know, and so forth, and then Lake George and Lake Crescent and so forth. And then you get into a springs area where the Ocklawaha River flowing out of Silver Springs comes in. You've got Silver Glen, Salt Springs, Satsuma Springs, just one spring after another in that section there. And then it turns into a river north of Lake George is where it becomes the St. John's River that I know and all. And it's really beautiful. And then when you get to Palatka, then all of a sudden it turns into a big, huge lake that's 70 miles long all the way up to Jacksonville.
Wow.
And then it pinches down again into Jacksonville when you get the river through Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And then it out to the Delta area. Or it used to be a Delta area at Mayport.
Yeah, so Mayport has the naval station. I would venture a guess that most people are familiar with St. John's River as it goes through Jacksonville, right by TIAA Bank Stadium, where the Jaguars play. Everyone's seen it on TV from the Gator Bowl or the Florida-Georgia game. And like you say, it has been dredged so that enormous cruise ships and the huge freighters carrying the tractor trailer containers, hundreds at a time can get through there. I drive along the St. John's all the time from that Mayport to Jacksonville stretch and see those enormous freighters and cruise ships go there all the time. And obviously the dredging there has left that part of the river in no way, shape or form like how William Bartram saw it.
That's right. It's an industrial ditch. There's a Bartram Island up there right in the middle of all that stuff. And I guarantee you, he never went there.
No, the Carnival cruise ship, if it would have passed him and his dad.
Exactly. That's right where it is.
It would have freaked him out worse than the Gators did. You mentioned about the springs. What did Bartram write about those springs? That must have been something pretty unusual for him.
Oh, gosh. His most flowery words are written about Salt Springs, where the words that he used to describe Salt Springs were actually used in the poem Kubla Khan by Coleridge, I think it is.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And, that's famous. It's a famous poem.
Yes. It's famous. And and there were two other poets that used his descriptions of Salt Springs there. And it's just a beautiful piece of a passage out of his book that describes not only the beautiful ether clear water is what he calls it. And it bubbles up and all this, and he describes it, but he also talks about the alligator and the garfish and the sheep's head and he names all the fish you can imagine that just get along really well together. Wow. And it's just beautiful, beautiful piece of passage that, again, people in Europe, especially when they saw those words, you know, I mean, it really creates a vision. And the way he writes, he draws you into that scene. Mm-hmm. He says, "And now we," and so you're sitting there, and you're going, "And now I," you know, me, I'm seeing this gin clear water and the animals and the fish, everything and the fish and all that. It's just beautiful script, beautiful. I say scripture. It's not really scripture, but it's
written that sort of flowery style.
No less exotic to him and audiences in Europe, I'm guessing, would have been than the alligators would have been the manatee.
Did he describe
manatee?
He did. He actually named Manatee Springs, Manatee Springs. That's over on the Suwannee at near, what is it, Fanning Springs is where it is. And that's where he again describes that spring. And not only that, but he describes the manatee carcass that the natives were partaking of at the springs.
What is the Bartram Trail Society of Florida?
It's kind of funny. It's like almost like being a Christian. How did you come to Bartram? You know, but mine started on a paddling trip. You know, my friend Dean Campbell and I—he was organizing a paddle trip over the whole St. John's River, and so we had done all the way up to, and when we got to Blue Springs, and we started coming north downstream from Blue Springs, Dean had had studied John Bartram in particular because of his journal. And the only Dean's job was working for St. John's River Water Management to restore the lower basin of the St. John's River. Restore it to what? The only documented scientific description of the St. John's River was John Bartram's journal. He knew all of it. Right. And then obviously by reading John Bartram's journal and going to William Bartram's journal, you can see how he came back and he went to the same places and everything. Mm-hmm. So as we're paddling up the St. John's River or down the St. John's River, you know, Dean would say, "Well, over there's where you did this and over there's where you did that." I'm going, "Holy cow." So when we get up to Palatka, which is where I live near Dunn's Creek on the St. John's River, you know, he's describing the stuff that Bartram did there. And I'm going, "Who is this guy?" And then, so he introduced me to the book, and I started reading the book just about my area. And so then when I'm reading this, I'm going, "I know where Dunn's Creek is. I can see it from my house. I know where Murphy's Island is. I can see it from my house. I know where Stokes Landing is. I used to fish there all the time. I know where all these places are." Yeah, it was really neat. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what got us excited. And then the city actually was redoing the waterfront in Palatka, and they asked the Putnam County Waterways and Trails Waterways Committee, "Did anything famous happen in downtown Palatka that they didn't know about?" And obviously Bartram's description of the waterfront in Palatka just fits us so well. It really does. You know, it's definitely a part of Bartram's travels. And it just, so I said, "Well, yeah, you know, Bartram thing." And so the county commissioner, Nancy Harris, said to me, "You know, Sam, you're in charge of the committee to figure out what's out there." And so I called Dean up and I said, "Hey, we got to go find all these places."
You had to go paddling again.
We did all 80 miles of the St. John's in Palatka, and we would go out and we didn't only just find the stuff that he mentioned in travels, but we went to John Bartram's journal and we found all of those sites too. So that in Putnam County alone, we found 31 sites that were written about by either John Bartram or William Bartram. And so that's where we put our stake in the ground, and we called it the Bartram Trail in Putnam County. Mm-hmm. And then the National Park Service heard about it, and in 2016, they designated this as a national recreation trail.
That's great.
So it was really an amazing trip. It was. It was meant to be.
It's great that you can sort of bring that history alive for people too and show them, you know, stuff he wrote about in the 1700s is still here, you know, and they can see that contrast and also see, you know, how it matches up.
Exactly. I mean, if you read his description of Salt Springs and then you go there now, you know that man has been here because they've screwed it up. Even though as pretty as it is, it doesn't match. You know, there's no eelgrass. Yeah. It looks like a desert. The fish are not there. And same thing at Salt Spring, at Silver Springs and so forth. And so, you know, we've really messed things up from where it was.
That's interesting because, you know, the people, the environmental advocates say that one of the biggest problems in Florida is what they call shifting baselines, that people who are getting here now think everything's hunky-dory because they didn't see what it looked like 10, 20 years ago. Well, this is sort of the ultimate baseline shift that, you know, what it was like in Bartram's day is a far cry from what it is now.
Exactly. And that was really precious to him. He has a, if you go and read his prayer in on page 100 of Travels, he's on Mount Royal, which is, again, here in Putnam County, and just across, you know, from one of the springs and all this, that, and the other. But he's praying to God that God would give him, man, the wisdom to take care of his creation. Wow. And it's so important to approach things that way because he was a Quaker. Mm-hmm. And so to him, his travels through Florida were honoring God's creation. And that was his prayer on top of Mount Royal, was that God would give him the wisdom to take care of this. And it really is. And that meant a lot to me and to the whole Bartram Trail Society, because then, you know, we became more of environmentalist oriented and taking care of what's here.
You know? Do you guys go out and clean up the trash that people leave and things like that? Or
in Putnam County, I can't find much. Yes, we do.
That's good. That's good.
But we do work with, you know, Keep Putnam Beautiful and all these groups that do that. But more than that, we try to educate people as to, you know, the value of the land, again, through Bartram's eyes. We have a Bartram Frolic every year, and the next one is going to be April the 22nd, 23rd, 24th in Palatka. There we have what we call a passport to the past on Saturday. And we'll have living history people. We'll have Jim Sawgrass portraying the Long Warrior, who is Bartram's buddy, the Seminole buddy while he was here. He was his friend and all. And then we also have Job Wiggins, who is portrayed by Robert Wilson. And he portrays Bartram's guide and interpreter that was here in Palatka. And we even have Billy Bartram portrayed by Mike Adams. And so they sit there and talk to the people and the kids, especially introducing them into this is, you know, William Bartram talks about, this is all the things that I wrote about, you know, these are plants and animals I wrote about. Joe Wiggins talks about what trading was and what, you know, how people lived during those times. And then Jim Sawgrass, being a Seminole, he talks about what life as a Seminole was in 1774. So it's a real education. And then the St. John's Riverkeeper came alongside and provided us with an education program for the second graders in Putnam County. And so far we've educated 2,500 second graders on the St. John's River. We've taken them for the first boat ride. We've taken them, you know, we have FWC is there and, mm-hmm. And we do a whole lot with it, but it's a fun event.
Yeah,
it really is.
And educational.
No, it's very educational.
Now, do you tell the kids about, I'm going to screw up this pronunciation, Puggy? Am I saying that right?
Yes. Okay. Actually, on the riverfront, Palatka has built a Puggy playground right there on the riverfront.
It's a fun word to say, but what does it mean? Where did that come from?
And his trek from the Spalding's Lower Store, which is where he stayed there in Palatka. It was at Stokes Landing. He trekked across to Payne's Prairie. I'm sure y'all know what that is.
Oh, yeah. Near Gainesville.
Payne's Prairie is where Tuscarawas was. And so the chief of the Seminoles in Tuscarawas was named Cowkeeper. And the cowkeeper, I believe his name was Aleha. And the cowkeeper, when he met William Bartram and Joe Wiggins and found out why he was there, he named him the Flower Hunter, Puck Puggy. That's how he got his name.
Nice.
And so Seminoles don't give white men names unless they're adopted as part of their family. Yeah. And so that dialogue is really amazing to see how they welcomed him into the, and they gave him free reign to go anywhere he wanted to. Because William Bartram didn't want their women. He didn't want their horses. He didn't want their plants, animals. He just wanted to observe everything. And they appreciated that because they were the same way.
Yeah. And their experience with Europeans certainly wasn't always along those lines, surely.
Yeah.
Looking at your BartramTrailSociety.com website, I understand that your section there of the trail in Putnam is just one piece of a much longer and more extensive vision for what eventually could become an enormous Bartram Trail.
Right. The actual Bartram Trail is 2,500 miles long, and it starts up in Charleston, South Carolina, and comes all the way down through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, across Alabama, by Mississippi, and all the way to Louisiana and back. And so that was his trek over those 3 years. So that's what, when you hear Bartram Trail, that's what the Bartram Trail actually is. Okay. In Florida, what we've done is to take our example in Putnam County. If you've seen that, you've seen how it's mapped out and how it's, you know, described and everything like that. And so what we've done is we've tried to work up and down the river to make the whole river a Bartram Trail. And so we have commitments from Nassau County, Duval County, St. John's County, obviously Putnam County, and Volusia County has already created theirs. And then Alachua County, obviously Paynes Prairie would be, has committed to develop a Bartram Trail there as well. So the only other county that's left is Escambia, which is Pensacola, is the only other county that he would have visited. You know, and everybody kind of wants to do it a little differently than we did it here, which is great with us. But that's what the Bartram Trail Society is doing, is they're trying to help these counties create their own ecotourism attraction. Wow.
Last one for me, and this is a topic we've discussed on the podcast a number of times, and as you're talking about Putnam County and Palatka and the St. John's River, this is all the area we're talking about, and that's the Ocklawaha River and the Kirkpatrick Dam and the effort to free the Ocklawaha River by taking out the Kirkpatrick Dam. What is your thought on that effort to get rid of the dam and free the river?
You got a few minutes? Yes. Listen, the first time that I went on the Ocklawaha River, I was about, I would say, 10 years old, and my dad put me in our 14-foot aluminum boat in near Palatka there, and they put 10 gallons of gas in that thing, and we would go as far up the Ocklawaha River as we could till the first gas tank ran out, and then we would turn around and head back. And that was how I was introduced to the Ocklawaha River. It was absolutely gorgeous. We never made it to Silver Springs. It was just too far. And then when we ran out of gas, we knew to turn around and head back, and we would fish all the way back. And it was just a pristine, beautiful, clear river. I looked forward to that every time we did it and all. And so we finally moved here to Palatka in 1964, you know, enjoyed it up until I went away to college. But the Ocklawaha River is a beautiful river. And the problem with the dam is when they put it in, and what the biggest damage that was done was the day that they put that dam in and started using it, we lost 140 million gallons of fresh, clear water a day to the St. John's River. And that is the largest tributary to the St. John's River, is the Ocklawaha River. And we strangled it, and we're paying the price now. And so as far as my opinion of what to do, they need to turn that river loose again, because the mud hole is not doing anything other than allowing a whole lot of water to evaporate. Yeah. And we need that flow going to restore the St. John's River. Forget about the paddling of opportunities and all the recreational opportunities. The Save Rodman people feel like that, oh, because it was a great bass fishing hole at one time, we shouldn't destroy it. Well, it was a great bass fishing hole before they destroyed it.
Yeah, and it will be again.
They tend to forget that. Right, exactly. And it's just like you're talking about. You know, the people here now that are for Saving Rodman didn't know it like I knew it. Mm-hmm. They don't understand what Silver Springs was like. Silver Springs was full of fish. And I learned a new term when I got involved with this thing by Dr. Knight. He used the term biomass. I don't know what biomass meant. So I asked him, what does it mean? He said, biomass is the living material in the, in a body of water. And so the Silver River, Silver Springs and the Silver River has lost 90% of its biomass.
Wow.
Since they That's put incredible. The dam in. It is incredible.
Yeah.
And so imagine yourself being me, having seen crystal clear waters and fish everywhere. And then going back now and people that see it now that have never seen it going, oh, what, how pretty. Look how the water, it's nice green color. Yeah. Well, that green color ain't good, number one. And number two, there ain't no grass. There ain't no fish. The only, the predominant fish in the Silver River now is the tilapia and exotic.
Yeah, and, that's not good.
It's a shame. The Ocklawaha River needs to flow free for a lot of different reasons. And the main reason that I'm passionate about it is because of the damage that it has done to the St. John's River. We have no eelgrass in the St. John's River, from Lake George all the way to Jacksonville. I mean, and that's where the fish live and all this, that, and the other. And there's so many things that, and the water's darker now than it's ever been. That's why there's no eelgrass. And it's, just a whole lot of things. But the river needs to be turned loose. And, that fishing hole doesn't cater to a whole lot of people. And it used to be a state-of-the-art bass place, but it's not anymore. The main channel is still there. That lake buries 20 freshwater springs.
Man.
Can you imagine? It's unbelievable. And as far as restoring it goes, all they really need to do is just draw it down and let nature take its course, because it was a swamp before. And guess what it'll be when they do it again?
Yeah.
A swamp.
Yeah. Which is what we need. So,
exactly what we need. What we need.
All right. So say I'm someone hearing this podcast going, wow, the Bartram Trail, what a great idea. Two questions. One, do I need to read the book in order to enjoy the trail? And two, where's the best place to start with paddling the trail?
If you have our brochure, number one, those are all detailed there in the brochure, the different trails. So we have hiking trails, biking trails, and paddling trails on the website, and you can download those. Those are all meant to be, 3 to 6 mile paddling trails. So there's 80 miles of waterways. There's about 15 miles of hiking trails that we detail. And then you can drive all over Putnam County. If they want to come and do that, my suggestion is start at the website and just go and see where you would like to see, and then go read what Bartram said about those places. And so that's the best way to do this thing. That's the way it was designed. It was designed to be a virtual trail, and you can do it sitting at your computer, but obviously you want to do it sitting in a kayak.
Absolutely.
And so there's to do it the way Bartram did it. That was our original dream, but you would have to start on Christmas Day in 1775. And be paddling.
Let me get my hot tub time machine out.
That's right, exactly. The neat part is that most of it is still there. Even the majority of the Bartram sites are public property, and which is really, really neat. So if you have a motorboat, you can go up and down and find probably 20 Bartram markers, and if you got the brochure, then the markers have a QR code, and it'll take you to the website and description of those sites. And Dean Campbell did a fantastic job of interpretation each of the Bartram sites. And that's what we're trying to get done in all these other counties, too. So eventually you'll be able to do that for the whole St. John's River. So it depends on how you want to travel.
Sam Carr, President, Bartram Trail Society of Florida, BartramTrailSociety.com. Thank you so much for your time today and the work you're doing.
Well, I hope I wasn't too verbose.
Unlike William Bartram, you were not.
Take care, Sam.
Okay. Yes, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You were a big paddler back in your childhood, Craig, yes. as you were telling me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in my Boy Scout troop, you know, we'd go camping, we'd go hiking, we'd do this other stuff. But the trips I really look forward to were the paddling trips, the canoeing trips, where I, you know, first got to paddle on Coldwater Creek and Blackwater River. You know, and then when my kids were in scouts, I really looked forward to when we'd have some canoe trips as well on the Little Manatee River. Because to me, that's the perfect way to travel. You're not under a lot of pressure. You're not racing. You're just kind of going with the flow, literally. Yeah. And if you're quiet, you can see some amazing stuff just by being out there and being, you know, not being noisy.
Absolutely. Yes. This episode of Welcome to Florida brought to you by Visit Sarasota, visitsarasota.com. And we've been highlighting some of the top beaches as we approach beach season here in Florida over the past couple episodes. How about Turtle Beach? A few miles south of the famous Siesta Beach, Turtle Beach has a relaxed end of the island feeling all its own. Walkovers lead across dunes that slope down to a narrow beach. 2,600 foot long beach, a favorite with surf casters who land grouper, cobia, sharks, and more. Sand is too soft for easy hiking, but hard pack path leads north along a dune line to Sanderling. And after just a few minutes, you'll look down at a grand expanse of nearly deserted beach, crystal clear waves lapping at a near shore sandbar with shorebirds chasing the incoming surf. Settle in on one of the benches along the path to read or watch for tortoises lumbering by. It's Turtle Beach. Visit Sarasota.com to find your perfect Sarasota beach. And
I have to stop. I need to go out there right now. That sounds great.
Sounds great, doesn't it? You know, yeah. One of the things for our conversation with Sam, you know, as a Floridian now, and when I get to daydreaming, I think of what this state, as beautiful as it is today, must have looked like, as he was talking about, 250 years ago.
Yeah.
Imagine the birds. Imagine the fish. Imagine how tall and big the cypress trees were. It's mm-hmm. something we'll never experience again. But what a great fantasy it is when I go there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Welcome to Florida.
Yeah.